I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Americans love unions. The idea of workers banding together to demand their rights from employers is so powerful. A recent poll found that unions are more popular than big corporations by a wide margin. According to the Economic Policy Institute, 16 million more workers joined unions in 2024, and millions more wanted to join but couldn't. Ahead of Labor Day 2025, we'll turn to Sean Richman, former labor organizer turned academic and author who teaches labor history at SUNY Empire State University. His latest book is called We Always Had a Union, The New York Hotel Workers Union 1912 to 1953. The book is a seminal history of how hotel workers in New York City organized more than 100 years ago, and it offers a powerful history lesson for today, especially in light of the anti-worker, anti-union policies of the Trump administration. Welcome to the program, Sean Richman.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about the origins of the industry where this group of workers whose history you write originated. We think today of hotels. Your story is about hotel workers. We think today of hotels as being, you know, very much part of any modern society. But in New York, in the early 1900s, it was, and even nationwide, really, it wasn't a very common thing to have big hotels, right? And which, of course, then begins the impetus for workers wanting to organize. So tell us that origin story of the industry itself.
Right. Well, you had public houses and you had inns, which was, you know, a person would have a house with an extra room or two. And that was very common, very connected to either railroad travel or stagecoach travel. What New York invented, and really it was the first families of New York that invented it, were factories of pleasure. And what they did is they cannibalized their own real estate. Fifth Avenue, from like 35th Street to 42nd Street was a row of just millionaires' mansions. Until William Waldorf Astor tore his own home down and turned it into the Waldorf Hotel, and emphasized, it was a much larger hotel, it was about 13, 14 stories, and emphasized extreme luxury and a lot of public dining and banquet halls and bars and restaurants laced throughout this hotel. That it became sort of a fashionable society thing, that they had one group of guests that were transient and were visiting, and then they had other people that were just at the Waldorf dining night after night to see and be seen, to walk down the hallway in their finery. And his cousin who lived next door got pretty annoyed by it, tore down his own home to build a competitor hotel that the manager of the Waldorf convinced him, let's just punch a hole between the walls, and that's how you get a hotel that has the hyphenated name Waldorf Astoria. And it created this building boom. This starts in like 1893, when the Waldorf opens up. And in the space of about 10, 15 years, dozens of hotels, each competing to be the newest, largest, most luxurious hotel, are opening up, and you're getting workforces of 500 people in a building, up to 1,000 and eventually 2,000 people in a building. At the height of banquet season, which is very seasonal, you could have 2,500 employees in a building.
So of course, when you have these big employers, you're going to have big collections of workers who are going to either be stepped on or organize themselves. And so let's talk about the workers. These were largely immigrant workers, which was, I think, by design. You sort of explained that the hoteliers wanted a cosmopolitan flair. They wanted people who were bilingual, trilingual, but they were mostly, of course, European immigrants at the time, right?
Right. It was by design. Oscar Churchky, who's the sort of the legendary maitre d' of the Waldorf Astoria, he made it a requirement of employment that his waiters and cooks could speak German and French and English at a minimum. Spanish, Italian, all extra. And what he got was a very cosmopolitan workforce, a globe-hopping workforce. These are people that would take a waiter job on a transatlantic ship, then stop over and do the season at maybe the St. George Hotel in Brooklyn or the Plaza Hotel up by Central Park, and then maybe at the end of the season get on another boat and maybe do the next year in London or in Paris. And the workforce that attracts in the 19-teens, particularly as World War I starts around them, is a group of workers who are just impatient for revolution. Because they're surrounded by this obscene wealth. And, you know, their orders are to sort of take their clientele's orders with military precision. And very little of that trickles down to them. And it's pretty offensive to them. And they start talking about organizing pretty early on. When I started researching this book, I thought the first strike in the hotel industry in New York was in 1912, which is when the book nominally starts. But then I found examples of strikes going back as far as 1869. But some of the more interesting ones were when Oscar Chirchky made his staff shave off their mustaches in 1903. They went on strike. You know, your mustache was a real sign of virility at that time. It was not an effective strike. These workers were knocking on the door of the official union for the industry, the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union of the AFL, but none too successfully. And the problems with the hotel and restaurant employees are several. One, they were sort of married to the craft form of organization. The idea that you sort of parcel out the members by craft. So there's a local union for cooks only. There's a local union for waitresses only, for bartenders only, et cetera, and so forth. They had a very top-down organizing model, largely based on making a deal with an employer, one of those smaller public houses or a bar, that they could hang a shingle outside that says, this is a union house or this is a union bar. And therefore, working class clientele would be encouraged to dine there. Now, this turns out to be actually very successful for the bartenders. The clear majority of bartenders in the country were unionized in the years before World War I, because most bars were working class in nature, and the central labor councils of the country were pretty good at enforcing. They wanted to drink at a unionized establishment. But the scale of hotels like the Waldorf Astoria and the McAlpin and the Plaza were frankly intimidating to the leadership of HERE. And on top of that, the leadership of HERE at the time was fairly nativist. And they even had a constitutional requirement for membership that if you weren't an immigrant, you had to at least commit to gain your citizenship within a certain number of years. And this was repulsive to the workers, who wound up forming an independent union when they staged that first strike in 1911, when my book starts.
Right. And so how did the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, influence and impact this organizing then? Because this is an aspect of the story, I think, that's also so interesting. When we look at, you know, the AFL still exists, the AFL-CIO exists, and it's considered one of the big establishment unions. But the Wobblies are living on in legacies, right?
Yeah, it was the Italians. The Italians did it. The 1911 strike is fascinating as sort of a bottom-up organizing campaign where workers were figuring it out for themselves what is successful and what is not. One of the things that wasn't successful is they went on strike relatively spontaneously around May 1st, and banquet season ends around Memorial Day. And so the jobs just dried up, and it didn't matter to the bosses that they were on strike. So they spent that summer of 1912 and fall of 1912 preparing for a new strike. And during that time, the cooks who were of Italian extraction were very excited by what happened in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and by Joseph Ettore and Giovannetti and Carlo Tresca, all these Italian union organizers, and they called them in for assistance, so that when the strike began at the stroke of midnight, New Year's Day, Within a couple of days, the old leadership of the union was pushed out, and the workers were taking the lead of IWW organizers. And ironically, even though the workers were attracted to these Italian men, the strike wound up getting led by Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who did a really amazing job of taking this bit of chaos and fashioning it into something that was, a parts boycott campaign, parts sabotage. Even the union meetings were sort of a technical marvel, because this is a 24-hour workforce. So to get the strike vote, they would rent out a hall and they'd have five meetings throughout the day, every couple of hours, as people clocked out of one shift or began another. This strike in the hotels that the IWW led is largely not remembered. To the extent that it is, it's remembered as an example of the IWW's sort of excesses of rhetoric, rhetorical extremism, instead of focusing on sort of the nuts and bolts of let's win union recognition and let's get a union contract. And so what happens is Joseph Ettore, who is in Lawrence, Massachusetts for the first couple days of the strike, finally comes down to New York to meet with the strikers, and there's a massive rally. And so in front of thousands of assembled workers and hundreds of assembled journalists, because this is front page news in all of the dozens of newspapers in New York City, he gives this speech. And at one point in the speech, he says to the workers, that it is the unsafest proposition in the world for the capitalists to eat food prepared by your hand if they force you to go back to work without union recognition.
Wow.
And the entire, establishment of the city is just appalled, and they take this as a signal to poison and murder and mayhem. And in reality, it was really more of he was playing with ideas of sort of more playful sabotage that the workers themselves had been engaging in. Even going back to that earlier strike in 1912. To them, sabotage was, substitute salt for sugar, overcook the fish slightly, maybe spill the coffee on the table kind of stuff, not, poison
Right.
the bosses. But the strike lost its consumer support as the workers regrouped, which I tell the story in the book. I sort of trace it. It took years from 1913 until the union rises up again in 1917. Years of sort of trial and effort, and many unions wooing these workers. The AFL came back in. They were sending organizers. They saw this as a missed opportunity that they wanted to gain back. They wanted to see these workers as a local of their union. And the IWW also saw it as a missed opportunity and would continually publish leaflets and appeal to these workers. But ultimately, the workers decided that they were turned off by both AFL-style craft unionism and by IWW extremism, and they sort of found this sort of middle path of amalgamationist unionism, which was a trend of the 1920s.
What are some of the lessons that we can learn today? I mean, hotel workers are still organizing. I'm here in Southern California, where tourism workers, that included hotel workers, organized and won the highest minimum wage in the nation at $30 an hour ahead of the Olympics, which they know is going to be a windfall for their employers. What are some of the lessons from the history that you wrote of New York hotel workers organizing that we can apply to today's organizing? We are again at a very ripe moment for unionizing, right?
Well, I always said when I was an active duty organizing director and when I was training organizers, that there aren't a lot of new ideas out there, but there are lots of old ideas that we forgot about. What I like about this story, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that in this 40-year period, you see this union effort experiment and change with the times. And instead of sort of doggedly pursuing the same strategy because that's the way we've always done it, they do these twists and turns. That 1912 strike's goal was union recognition and a closed shop, and a union contract. Then the union spends the 1920s not wanting to sign any kind of union contract. And one of the sort of principles they took away from the IWW was no contracts with time limits and no contracts certainly with no strike clauses. And what they did from during that period is they ran their own union hall, And they were able to enforce union standards by selectively striking against specific hotels. So you get to the point where the Plaza Hotel would call up the union and say, we need 20 extra waiters tonight. And the union would supply them at the wage rate that the union and the employer agreed upon that became the area standard, $15 a week. Haha, fight for 15. And they would retain the right that if the employer ever reneged on that, which the Plaza did in 1923, they could just strike in the middle of the meal. And that's why they spent the 1920s. When they did strike, it was they put out the soup, they take the dinner orders, and then they leave and leave those rich people stranded.
So, like a work to rule form?
You can translate it as a work to rule, but it really it's if there's no contract, there's nothing stopping you from striking that way, right? So that kind of notion of you plan for a strike and it's going to be at D-Day at H hour is really something that's enforced by the current state of the law. All kinds of case law at the NLRB requires strikes to be sort of all out things. Where you give the employer sufficient notice. In that pre-legal times, the union recognized that spontaneity or seeming spontaneity. They were certainly preparing, but they weren't giving the boss any notice. Why would you? That at a minimum you would get a good hit that night when you ruined that dinner and the boss had no time to hire scabs. And then maybe you showed up and reported for lunch the next day, and beggars can't be choosers, and they hire you. And then maybe you went back out for strike two dinners later. That sort of leaving the employers guessing thing was another thing they did. Sabotage, as I said, it was totally a tactic and a method in 1912 and 1913. Then for a while, it was sort of discouraged that to the extent that the union did sabotage, it was more these sort of spontaneous and quickie strikes that while they were working. Particularly because they were doing a hiring haul, they wanted the reputation of our men are quality men and we're not going to break your glassware. And then, by the 1934 strike, that's out the window. And not only are they not presenting the boss with one unified union, there are three unions competing against each other. They're explicitly breaking windows of employers that won't negotiate. They're explicitly destroying property. And then they pivot from there in 1934, thanks to the emerging new labor laws and thanks to a lot of political pressure from people like Mayor LaGuardia, who were tired of seeing the hotel industry in such a state of chaos. When the hotel industry signed a neutrality card check agreement, the union fashioned a system of labor peace with the hotels that exist to this day, with labor courts that actually have precedence when it comes to grievances. That a grievance filed at the Plaza over improper layoff practices, it becomes the law for all of the hotels in the city and has produced a tremendous amount of employment stability and business stability for the employers ever since. But again, this sort of this changing with the times, I think, is one of the major lessons. And one of the other ones, I guess, is because I've got this background as an organizer, I go a little bit deeper in terms of whatever historical record is left, which you're left with old newspapers, maybe a couple of memoirs or whatever, and really try to understand the conversations that workers were having with each other about tactics and strategy, and try to demystify some of this. Because I think that for workers today, one of the most intimidating things always is just how to start. So to look at how another group of workers started, maybe didn't get it right the first time, but got over that hump of let's try something and then let's learn from that and let's try something different after that, is I
Right. So
think
taking
one of the crucial
action.
lessons for today.
Right, taking action, being inspired by other actions. And these sorts of things can be a contagion, right? And that's what's so powerful about them. That's why often employers and sometimes whole industries will spend more money to suppress a strike or suppress unionizing than it would cost them to just give the union what it wants because they are worried about the contagion effect that it would spread among workers. Well, finally, Sean, let me ask you about the militancy aspect of this. I mean, some of the things that you outlined by today's standards would seem very risque, a little too militant. Some of our unions have gotten a little tame. Is it time to bring back stronger tactics? And, of course, not to suggest physical violence against other humans, but stronger tactics that may veer into property destruction, to make a point.
Yes, it's time to expand our arsenal of tactics. I want to make two points. One, that this union still exists today. It's the New York Hotel Trades Council, which has a reputation for being conservative, but I think that's largely based on who they endorse in the mayoral or gubernatorial elections here. From a shop floor perspective, it is still a very militant union. I used to work there. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book. And we would go on strike during the terms of the contract. I was amazed by that. We would have lobby meetings, where if we were in a dispute with the Hilton Corporation over, maybe over the closure of a restaurant at the Hilton Times Square, we could have a lobby meeting at the Waldorf Astoria and call all the room attendants down and all the cooks out of the kitchens and all the front desk workers out and take over the lobby and talk to the workers about what's going on and make some demands and leave management scrambling to check in guests and get the work done. And we'd scamper back to work, before the day was over. But those sorts of things, even with no strike clauses, which are sort of pernicious and pervasive in the labor movement, which really do limit your ability to do those sorts of actions when the terms of a contract are in, there's still some ability to sort of, engage in some puckishness with the employers that you have under contract. In a non-union work environment, I've gone out on a short, sturdy limb to predict that the Roberts Supreme Court is going to overturn the National Labor Relations Act. There are cases that are working their way through the federal courts, and they're just based on we got a 6-3 majority and we're doing it. Elon Musk wants it to happen. Jeff Bezos wants it to happen. It's going to happen, I think, about a year from now, year and a couple months maybe.
The
And in
National
that
Labor
environment,
Relations Act established the NLRB, I believe, right?
the
The
National Labor Relations Act is the main federal labor law. It's the
Wow.
one that grants the right to organize, right to strike, forces employers to bargain in good faith that are certified. Not all workers are covered by it. And there's a plethora of state laws as well, but it's the main one.
So if there was ever a time to escalate, now
Well,
would be it.
if you're in an environment where there's no longer such a thing as protected concerted activity, right? One of the reasons that unions have limited the kinds of protest activity that they'll do is that the difference between having a protected activity where you can't be fired, or if you are fired, we can get your job back, versus unprotected, where you could just be fired for doing it, is pretty significant. So unions have focused on the protected activity. If there's nothing protected, then everything's on the table.
There you go. Well, I want to thank you so much, Sean, for joining us today. What's a good place for people to follow your work and read more about your writings? Of course, they can get copies of your books at bookstores, but how can they follow you online?
I got a website, seanrichmond.org. You can also find me at seanrichmond.org on Blue Sky.
Thank you very much again, Sean, for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Sean Richmond. He teaches labor history at SUNY Empire State University, and we've been talking about his new book, We Always Had a Union, The New York Hotel Workers Union, 1912 to 1953. His previous book was Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.